Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Excommunication. What rules apply and why? The Flaming Sword of the Archangel Michael. A Guido Reni masterpiece. Only 33 days in office, tribute to a Pope to remember. And reflecting on the parable of the Good Samaritan. Thanks very much for joining me once again. This week, the Holy See excommunicated the Zambian Archbishop Emmanuel Milingo, after he ordained four married men as bishops. As we know, excommunication has been used throughout the history of the Church. But what exactly does it entail? What is its purpose? And how often and for what reasons is it used? To find the answers to these questions, Susie Hodges spoke to two experts on canon law in the Church.
Father Michael Hilbert is the Dean of the Faculty of Canon Law at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He began by telling me what excommunication means in concrete terms.
Well, excommunication is a penalty, it's a censure, by which a person is excluded from the communion of the faithful. And it brings with it a certain number of consequences, of effects, which are the deprivation of certain spiritual goods of the Church. They cannot receive the sacraments.
Father John Connolly is the president of the Canon Law Society in Britain. He stresses that the main aim of excommunication is not to punish the offender, but rather to bring about his or her reconciliation with the community of the Church.
Excommunication primarily is about correcting the person. Certainly, there is an element of showing how a particular offence is of such a nature that it must be punished, and sometimes the punishment must be of a permanent nature, like the loss of the clerical state. But above all, excommunication is about correcting the person so that they may return to full communion with the Church. So it should be seen in a positive light, and not in, shall we say, a caricature of an authoritarian Church thundering at some poor person.
And what are the main offences it's used for?
One could be excommunicated for apostasy, heresy, schism, desecration of the Eucharist, physical force against the Pope, ordination of a bishop without a papal mandate, direct violation of the sacramental seal, procurement of a completed abortion or assisting in that. An excommunication can either be declared or it can be automatic. In that sense, the Latin Church differs from the Eastern Catholic Churches. In the Eastern Catholic Churches, it can only be declared. In the Latin Church, it can be automatic, and that can have its good and its negative sides. The positive side is that it indicates a particular offence is of a very serious nature, like a priest breaking the seal of confession. He is automatically excommunicated, and therefore it's obvious that he must amend his ways. However, it also depends a lot on the individual's own conscience and faith, because if I tell someone about someone else's confession, who knows? I know I've broken the seal of confession, therefore I'm the only one who knows I'm excommunicated. So a lot will depend on my own faith, my own conscience, my own devotion to the Church and the Holy Father. Therefore, there must be an element in a person to be wanted to be reconciled. So for excommunication, in one sense, to be effective, aside from showing that a particular offence is of a serious nature, it needs to be also able to help reconcile the individual. And therefore, when it is, shall we say, declared, the whole good of the Church, as well as the individual, is taken into account. So, for example, if an atheist politician, although baptised a Catholic, is excommunicated, it may have a positive effect. It may warn Catholics that this atheist has particular views, beliefs, which are contrary to Church teaching, and they should be warned about them. But equally, it could have a negative effect. It could be that those who hate the Church it might be a call to them to rally to this fellow.
But nowadays, is it mostly clerics or lay people who get excommunicated? Father Hilbert again.
Well, it's not used really very often at all. It's very rarely used, I would say. I guess the declaration of an excommunication in recent years has really been against clerics.
Who can excommunicate? I mean, obviously the Pope, but who else besides him?
I think we have to make the distinction between an automatic excommunication and an imposed excommunication. An automatic one is where the person himself or herself excommunicates himself or herself. That is, that they break the communion with the Church. They close the door themselves, and that would be an automatic excommunication. And so it's not imposed. It's by the very act itself, it happens. And the Church just, with regret and sadness, takes note of that fact and declares it. On the other hand, there are the imposed excommunication, which is a censure, a punishment which is imposed at the end of a trial, and that can be imposed by anyone with the power of governance.
Such as?
Such as a bishop, the local bishop for his local area.
How does absolution from excommunication work? Because it's only through absolution that an excommunication comes to an end, isn't it?
No, I think the term absolution is not the exact term there. We remove the censure. The censure can be removed when the person has repented of whatever they have done. That is not absolution in the sacramental confession sense. But when the person repents of what they've done, then the censure is to be lifted and communion is to be restored.
And when you talk about lifting the censure, is it the same person who imposed the excommunication in the first place who has the right to do it, or does it have to be a higher up authority?
No, in general, the person who has imposed it, if they've had the competence to impose it, are the ones then to remit it.
Father John says before the church authorities decide to excommunicate somebody, they are careful to make sure that the person is actually guilty of the offence and that there are no mitigating factors which could alter their judgment.
Although we talk about automatic excommunications, they have to then also be declared to show that the person is actually culpable. Because although outwardly somebody might have committed an offence, there may be circumstances or things which would say they are not culpable. So you can't be excommunicated if you haven't completed your 16th year. If you didn't know you were committing an offence, you can't be excommunicated. So you can't do it by accident. If you're forced to commit the offence, then of course you're not culpable. Or if you acted out of fear or you lacked reason. So although priests might say break the seal of confession, he's automatically excommunicated. However, when you looked at the circumstances, one might find there might be mitigating factors. So one has to be careful about saying that. So if it is declared, then someone has been tried, has a chance to defend their position and refuse to reconcile themselves to the Church. It's not the Church so much rejecting them, because the Church is always reaching out, wanting the person to amend their ways and to come fully into the sacramental life of the Church. So if it's a declared excommunication, that's one thing. If it seemed to be incurred, then the Church would take a different approach until all the facts could be known.
You have any examples of really famous people in the past who've been excommunicated?
John I of England, Henry VIII, Elizabeth I, Archbishop Talleyrand in France, Father Feeney in Ireland, and I believe Father Balasaraya from Sri Lanka, but that was later revoked.
And Martin Luther?
Oh yes, of course, I forgot all about him, yes. And Martin Luther, yes.
Do you have any idea, in fact, what percentage of those who are excommunicated sometimes come back to the fold?
No, I wouldn't have any idea of what percentage would come back. I suppose in day-to-day life, in service of the confession, the sanction of excommunication that's put on abortion, there, you know, people do repent and they are restored to full communion. Many, I would say, of those.
The goal of excommunication is to bring back the person within the fold of the Church. But as Father Michael explains, there are some potential pitfalls involved in making use of this censure.
It's been misunderstood. It's often seen as an authoritarian church imposing its views, Whereas, in fact, you look at excommunication, it's about correcting someone. It's about helping someone see that what they've done, the position they're holding, is damaging to the church, to humanity. And the excommunication is there to not punish them or drive them out of the church, because you're not banished from the church. You don't lose your baptism. You might not be able to receive the Eucharist, but there'd still be the expectation you'd be there on Sunday. So, because of the way it's sometimes perceived in a negative light, the church is very careful about how it's used, because it could be that someone who's very anti-church might actually welcome to be excommunicated because of the publicity it would give them within certain circles. And the aim of reconciling the person would be impossible if not within that person's goal in wanting to be excommunicated.
My thanks there go to Jesuit Father Michael Hilbert, Dean of the Faculty of Canon Law at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome, and to Father John Connolly, who's President of the Canon Law Society in Britain. Both interviewed there by Susie Hodges. And now to break the pace in this broadcast, let's go arty by joining our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, in the Church of Our Lady of Conception, just off Rome's famed Via Veneto, where she's about to share with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Going Baroque, she offers us an artist's vision of a Guido Reni painting depicting the Archangel St. Michael, whose feast day falls together with those other archangels, Gabriel and Raphael, on September 29th. It's a painting inspired by another masterpiece, signed no other than Raphael, this time the artist, now hanging on the walls of the Louvre in Paris. Stay tuned.
Look at the frame around the actual altar painting. It's all ebony wood inlay, which is unusual because you tend to find marble and cold colours. Here you have the brown, and out of the middle of all that brown explodes this ferocious figure of St. Michael the Archangel, intent on crushing evil. And he does it really well. Look at his foot, which is smack bang on the head of the devil, like, get down and stay down. Yeah, and you can see in the background the flames coming up behind the rocks just near his feet. Also, St. Michael himself is wearing the most incredible boots, seem to be made of filigree lace and gold and sort of turquoisey colour, which matches, again, the bluey turquoisey robes that he's wearing. And he has a mantle of red, which seems to change on the two sides of the painting. You see on the left there, it's a big mass of pink, warmish pink. It seems to match with the flames in the hell below. And on the other side, you have a colder type of pink, which matches the flesh of the devil who's lying crouched and naked down at the bottom of the painting with his two hands splayed onto the rocks, trying to hang on, stay in the world and do evil. It gives you a sense of the excessive aspect of evil. You know, you just get the feeling that it's a lot. When it's there, it's generally a lot. You feel that. And if you look up above at him, it's a figure of purity, a face of great intent and purity. There's something really clean about this figure. So it's a contrast, in my opinion, between the good and the evil, also in physical terms. He's trying to accentuate aspects of the two of them. Michael is very slim, but he's also very strong. And the devil is sort of excessively overweight, with a sort of disgusting-looking expression on his face. And yet, you look up at Michael and he's holding his sword with great
grace.
Well, yeah, grace, but also power. Eh? Michael the Archangel is not an angel who messes around. I mean, he's a strong figure. He just cuts through all the garbage and gets right to the point. that's probably why, you know, he has such an extraordinary image generally in painting. At the top of the painting, look at the wings, big wide wings which take up the entire painting, go from one side to another. And these are nicely balanced out in the back by rocks and mist that you can see behind the figure. Generally, when we're talking about Baroque, you see the diagonal line of the arms, the two arms, you see the diagonal of the sword coming down towards the devil. His own legs are in a diagonal. The cloak he's wearing is swirling in the wind. He's also a diagonal, and he has a type of string coming right down through the robes and coming out behind his leg, which is a sort of pale violet. And very similar to the colour that Michelangelo used for God the Father in the Sistine Chapel. It's so graceful, and yet it's a powerful figure. He is literally walking out of this painting. He's just going to walk out onto the altar and walk down with the sword. This is one of the things I love about St. Michael. He's always portrayed on the move.
He was very young looking, though.
Well, he's a soldier, in a sense, you know, because he's a soldier of God. So he's showing there the youth, the power, the strength. And then below that, the older person, the more dissipated person, personifying the devil. So it's just the contrast between the clean and the unclean.
The wings don't seem to fit into the picture. Maybe it's because of the frame, no?
Yeah, well, that's deliberate, you see, because the idea is if a little part of the wings remains outside the painting, it means that you imagine the painting bigger than it really is. So generally when you have figures that don't finish inside the painting itself, your imagination will finish it for you outside the frame, and it elaborates and enlarges the entire scene.
Thanks there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, speaking there of Guido Reni's depiction of the Archangel Michael. Meanwhile, let's pay tribute to a Pope who died on the 28th of September 1978, whose recordings in English we hold dear here as keepers of all the Pope's voices since the founding of our radio station by Pope Pius XI. Listen then to the voice of John Paul II and to the voices of some of those who personally knew him. Or remember that incredible moment when they learnt of his death only 33 days into his pontificate. The actual sound of the bells of St. Peter's, tolling to let the world know the newly elected Pope was dead. Barely a month had gone by since they had tolled for Paul VI, and people in Rome listened in disbelief, people like Archbishop John Foley.
Well, I had a great sense of disbelief. I remember I was at home and somebody knocked at my door at 4 a.m. and said, "The Pope died." And I said, "I know the Pope died. You know, they elected a new one a month ago." And they said, "No, this Pope died." I couldn't believe it.
Or like Cardinal William Wakefield Baum.
One of my priests called me. It was about 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. And he said, "I'm sorry to call you, but I think you should know the Pope has died." And my first reaction is, "You're mistaken. You must have been listening to a program about the death of Pope Paul VI.
He had been reading one of his homilies. I was there. I never left his side.
Bishop John McGee, now, personal private secretary to Pope John Paul I.
It was a box which contained transcribed homilies from the time he was bishop in Vittorio Veneto right through. And before going to sleep, he would read over, because he told me he wanted to refresh his mind, because now that he was Pope, he would have to give many homilies.
Dear sons and daughters, your presence is a great joy for me, because I love you all very much. And it is about love that I want to speak to you today."
His pontificate, although brief, was, from our point of view, a moment of grace. The world reacted with great joy to the election of John Paul I. Immediately, the world embraced him. Now, he had that ability to communicate, even without words. I believe that's correct. He again appeared to everyone as a very loving father.
Cardinal Baum was one of the members of the College of Cardinals that elected John Paul I.
It's like a retreat. It's a very prayerful experience. We spend most of our time in prayer and reflection. That's the spirit of the conclave. It's not what the world might think. And I'd like to emphasize that it is a spiritual experience, truly a retreat. It's mysterious what takes place. The operation of the Holy Spirit is with us. It's indefinable, but we are aware of it.
From the very beginning, Pope John Paul I was more than surprised that he was elected. And you say frequently, in my presence, at table frequently, why was I chosen, he said. And I remember he died on a Thursday night. On the Tuesday night, we're sitting at table. And again he spoke about preoccupation of his as, how could he have been chosen? He considered himself most unworthy.
Our Heavenly Father wants us perfect like himself. God wants us to make progress in love with my apostolic blessing.
When he came here for the conclave, I remember sometimes I used to tease him about the thing, you see. He never suspected that he would have been elected Pope.
Augustinian Father Prosper Grech was head of the religious house where Cardinal Luciani stayed in the days preceding the conclave. Ironically, the house faces the papal apartments on the other side of St. Peter's Square.
Somebody had been lobbying for him, you see. He didn't like the thing. In fact, he never went out. He was always in our garden. If anybody wanted to bring up the conclave subject, he would, you know, just shy away.
I remember the conclave itself. We thought, well, you know, it'll go on for some time. The cardinals meet together and have their various...
Vatican journalist Arthur Baum recalled the atmosphere in St. Peter's Square and in the radio commentator's box on the day of the election.
Smoke came out of the chimney on the Sistine Chapel, which, as usual, you couldn't tell whether it was white or black, so no one knew what was happening.
Whitish colour the smoke is, according to Antoine.
Mi trovo in una situazione un po' delicata, non posso annunciare.
As to explain what colour the smoke was, Antoine, speaking very naturally and very normally, said dirty white. I think he perhaps should have said off-white.
And then suddenly, up in the Vatican, I saw one of the doors open and some sisters came running out. There was an unusual in the middle of a conclave. And I waited on, together with many others, of course. And about half an hour later, the doors on the loggia of St. Peter's Basilica onto the square opened and a cross-bearer appeared in liturgical vestments. Oh, I think it can only mean one thing. That's the end of it, the conclave. They've actually got it all over in one voting session. And in fact, the procession then came and we heard the news which... has been repeated many times, I think, the usual words, annuncio vobis gaudium magnum.
Annuncio vobis gaudium magnum.
I tell you a great joy. We have a new pope.
The cross is appearing.
Voici la croix.
Cardinal Pericle Felici is on the central loggia of the Vatican Basilica.
He would go to the chapel at 6:15 every morning. We had an hour and a quarter of prayer. And the first quarter of prayer would be the recitation of the Divine Office, which he insisted would be read in English. And one Sunday evening I was with him. He asked me, he said, I want to sit and talk with you. And he talked to me about many things, about his priestly life, his episcopal life, pontifical life. Then he said, would you do me a favour tomorrow morning? Would you say Mass for me? Holy Father, I said, I have said Mass practically every morning. No, he said, I mean, would you celebrate Mass? And in his own words, he says, you celebrate Mass in English. He served the Mass. At the end of Mass, he received my blessing. He did that three times during the 33 days.
And I'd like to end the broadcast on a more reflective note by going over to Father Gerald O'Collins, a Jesuit who's also a well-known author, who's going to reflect for us on the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Years ago, on an agreeable summer's evening in Sydney, I was walking down a suburban street with my sister and a female cousin of ours. At that time, my sister was a social worker, our cousin a nurse, and I had just been ordained a priest. As we walked along, we came across a man sitting on the footpath. His feet were dangling in the gutter, and his body gently swaying backwards and forwards. The strong smell of spirits caught us as we went by. Half an hour later, the three of us came back along the same street. Some paramedics were loading the man on board their ambulance. He was drunk all right, but he'd been sitting down because a car had hit him, broken his leg, and failed to stop. "We've just repeated the parable of the Good Samaritan," my sister commented. "Only this time, instead of a priest and a Levite passing by on the other side, it's been a case of a priest, a social worker, and a nurse passing by on the same side." How right my sister was, and how practical and demanding Jesus is in his parable of the Good Samaritan. He wants us to stop and help any neighbours in distress that we come across on the road of life. Jesus himself was totally at the service of others, of those who desperately needed him and his help. He was the Good Samaritan in person. He stopped to heal our wounds and carry us to safety. In the parable he told, the Good Samaritan put the wounded traveller up on his donkey and then walked ever so slowly, holding the man on the saddle, until they reached the inn further down the road. It was a generous and a dangerous thing to do. Bandits had struck once when they wounded and robbed the traveller. They could easily have been waiting to strike again around the next corner. And who is more vulnerable than a man holding a wounded person in the saddle and walking along ever so slowly beside a donkey? In stopping to help and heal us, Jesus did a most generous thing and a most dangerous thing. And they did come for him. This Good Samaritan stopped to wounded people and was struck down, wounded, and killed himself. Jesus paid for his real love with his own life. Yes, the parable of the Good Samaritan is a terribly demanding story. It calls on us to get involved at any time and with anyone who desperately needs our help. That parable sets the standard awfully high. But we have this comfort. Jesus himself lived out that parable to the uttermost, and he's always there to give us the strength and help we need to put his words into practice.
You've been listening to a reflection by Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
Laudator Jesus Christus.